We are Black Food Folks.
We are Black Food Folks.
Welcome back to Black Desserts. I'm your host, Therese Nelson. For episode 5, we're exploring the light and shade of Afro-nostalgia. The world of desserts can feel indulgent and decadent in ways that overlook the practical impact our cultural relationships with food can have on our lives. There's a wonderful book called Afro-Nostalgia You Should Check Out by Dr. Badia Ahad. In it, she explores the beauty of nostalgia as what she considers an essential cultural heirloom. She looks at many areas of Black culture to unpack this framework, but for me, it's in our food ways, and more specifically our baking traditions, that nostalgia is most powerfully illustrated. It's in the joy and celebration, it's the emotional connection and comfort in good and bad times that our dessert traditions become a generational heirloom as much as the recipes themselves. On this episode, we explore this idea by talking with two amazing women who utilize desserts to interrogate and support our emotional connections while we eat from opposite ends of the spectrum. We begin in the light and spend time with Shelly Chapman, a multi-talented, multi-hyphenate creator who uses her practice to help her clients reclaim their cultural relationships with eating.
I'm Shelly Chapman, also known as Shelly Wellness, and I am the founder of the School for Mindful Nutrition, and I'm also the host of the Mindful Plates, a YouTube channel with weekly cooking videos. I have been working in food in this way for about 12 years, and currently I am teaching that mindfulness aspect. So for years, I've just been documenting my own journey, but what I realized is that journey was so freeing for me, not just freeing and releasing weight that I didn't need to carry anymore physically, but also freeing and releasing emotional and spiritual weight that had been with me for years that was affecting my journey in a way that I didn't even know until I started eating food, seeing food, looking at food, interacting with food as an ally to my well-being instead of something to just be consumed. Now, the food in me is still there. We are down for consumption. But adding that ally friendship aspect has been healing. So currently, I am the founder of the School for Mindful Nutrition. And in that school, I invite women and men to come and do the same thing, especially if they find themselves in a journey where food has become a struggle or a challenge, and it's not supporting them or assisting them, but more so creating more harm. And so I know that food has been not just a healer to me, but it's a healer to the earth. It's healing in of itself. And so I want to expand on that knowledge and that practice with others. And then I also host the cooking show called The Mindful Plates on YouTube, where I teach people how to make more mindful approaches and tips to their meals. And say, for example, you grew up on a dish and that dish is no longer serving you, but you still have the emotional connection to it. You have the memories that are with it and you still want to eat it. And so what I show you is how to make the food swaps and substitutes that are going to be more supportive of the body, but still allow you to enjoy that memory.
I've always been fascinated by Shelly's grounded approach to thinking about food and desserts. Her work has always been about restoring dignity and joyfulness to our food ways as a way to rewire our relationships with food. She has an amazing way of getting down to the visceral nature of nostalgia and helping us reframe some of the more indulgent foods we eat in a more healthful and modern context.
I grew up in Atlanta, and I remember church functions, after church functions, or any holiday at the church, getting together with family reunions, Sundays at grandma's, Saturdays too, and birthday parties, or even just going to a soul food restaurant like The Beautiful, and wanting to ensure Deacon Burton's, which is no longer around, but that was in the 80s, but wanting to ensure that there's room for this dessert at the end. And what I've come to realize is that there's a difference between the memories and the food, and we put them together. And when we put them together, we begin to think that the food is the memory. So we continue to eat it. And what happened for me was I was experiencing, like I mentioned, weight gain, but I was also experiencing some health symptoms that I'd never had before. And as I started shifting my diet, it became so present to me that what was on my plate was causing the discord and the disharmony in my body. But yet the memory was so beautiful. How could that be? So I was deciding to shift it and say, okay, the memory is there. Like I can create the memory. I can recreate the memory and I can still eat the thing, but I need the thing to support me. I need the thing to honor me because how can I eat something that dishonors the memory by taking away my vitality? And that was just like, no, I'm not down for it. I still want peach cobbler though. I still want pound cake though. So I started researching and looking, and that's when I started being introduced to vegan and plant-based foods. A lot of people think I'm vegan. I'm not. I'm plant-based. However, I support a lot of vegan whole foods because as I eat them, they remember me. And I want to break down that word, like the re coming again and the member, seeing myself as a member, I'm put back together again when I eat those foods that are rooted in the earth. And so if I can find a way to make pound cake and red velvet cake and peach cobbler, which I'm still working on red velvet, but peach cobbler I have. I got banana pudding too. Like I found ways to make those. And so now the memory is more whole almost because I get to eat it without any sense of discord, but with all the sense of harmony and joy that is intended to bring and still live into that memory. When you're talking about the heirloom recipes, what comes to mind is that if you think about any generation, there's always the food of the time. And the food of the time is based on what's accessible, what ingredients are available. And so if we start to rethink our recipes as still heirlooms, but they're guides. And I've always said this, I am not a strict recipe follower. I own over 50 cookbooks, but I am not a recipe follower. And so what our grandmother hands down to us, whether it's written or just in the experience of the memories of the taste of it, what our parents hand down to us, all of that is literally the blueprint. And then what you do in your time, in your brilliance, you look at not only what's available, but out of what's available, what is going to honor this memory by honoring your being? And you take that and you use that instead. You substitute. And if there's still something that's honorable, keep it in the recipe. Because ultimately, taste and texture can be achieved a gajillion ways. And so there's not any one way to do it. I've been working with several ingredients lately, but more than anything, what I've been less ingredient and more technique is what I've been really focusing on lately. So just the other day, I made some chanchon. If you've ever had Haitian rice, then chan, that beautiful black rice with the mushroom. And I've been making jollof rice as well lately. And what is most interesting about the rice making, also Dominican rice and peas, arroz con habichuelas. But what's very interesting about the rice making is the process is required to infuse that flavor into the rice. And what I'm seeing in Haiti, in Nigeria, in Ghana, because specifically I've been cooking those cuisines lately, is that there is a process of grinding all of your herbs and your seasoning together. And so whatever's going to impart that flavor, like bringing that together. Now we use blenders now, but mortar and pestle. And if you've ever had food made with a mortar and pestle versus a blender, it tastes different, it hits different, it looks different. There's something I think about the mortar and pestle, and it takes concentration and time. So you have to be able to settle your energy into the art and the practice and the moment of this food making. Whereas when you put in a blender, you can walk away. It's metal. It's computerized. It's electric. It's a different energy that goes into it. Now, that might be subtle for some, but I know that what happens is even if you're not tasting it, you're feeling it. So I just find it so lovely and God-giving that this technique managed to cross the seas and stay, and it's present, and I can still have access to that. Because something else I think about is that as Black people, the amount of trauma we've been through in the West as a result of the West inflicting themselves in history in the way that they have, is that these foodways have survived, and it's medicine for us. And if we can continue to, whether it's reconnecting with the ingredient or the technique, that we can continue to bring that into our kitchen as a way to remember us. I keep saying that, remember us before the trauma, before the foolishness, before the bacchanal, before the wahala. We can be here with our food. And I love that all these traditions are just with us in this life.
Shelly's point of view especially resonates with me because it's so rooted in culture. Her work seeks to both recenter diaspora cuisines as well as decolonize our kitchen.
just remember being loud and clear. This is back in 2009 when I started my blog. I'm tired of seeing only French and Italian cuisine. This is back in 2009, being celebrated and being shown as if it is the food. There are so many of us. How could this be? I grew up with a Jamaican mother and a Black American father, living in Europe, traveling through Africa and the Caribbean. By the time I was 11, I had those experiences. So my childhood was filled with our melanated brilliance across the globe. And the way that it showed up on plates and the way that it left people with a feeling of home and love. And that's something that, like, you can't always capture that in a recipe book. Like, you cannot, that's something you have to have running through you. It has to be, because I always say, like, your hands are an ingredient too. What's transmitted through them into the food. And so if we're just studying the quote unquote classic, we're also missing a part of ourselves. And people have asked me in the past, oh, why didn't you go to culinary school? And I always said, because I honestly thought back in 2009, when I was switching over from being a Spanish teacher to now becoming a personal chef and food blogger, that I was going to lose the soul and the spirit of my cooking. I thought it would be taught out of me. And so I don't want it taught out of me. And I actually don't want to learn that. What I want to learn is what traveled over from the motherland through her diaspora, because I'm a child of her diaspora. I'm her daughter. And for me, it's important. The eating reconnects me to the mother. And so when I get to go back and I'm seeing all these links, like, wow. And it's not just what we're eating. It's the way that we're eating. And that, I think, was something that was missing, which was why for years, and from age 16 to 23, I suffered heavy from disordered eating. I was a huge overeater and emotional eater. And how I was eating was governed and informed by a culture that was not my own. And so now I'm returning back to my mother as her daughter. And what I'm learning is, for example, the first time I had Ethiopian food, I remember we all sat around one table and the plate was about as large as the table. It's not called a plate, forgive my ignorance, but it was about as large as the table. And all the food was on there and we all had to share. And for the first time in my life, I realized that the idea that we get in Western culture of individualism, that a dish is for you and you only, and there's no impact on whatever you eat, that you can just eat whatever you want, however much you want. You don't have to think about anyone else. And if you don't want to eat the food, oh, well, throw it away if you want seconds, get seconds, get thirds, get fourths, get fifths. Why not? And when I was sitting at that table eating in Jeddah, and I had to be thoughtful for the first time in my life, somebody else has to get in Jeddah. I was like, oh, man, this is what community is. I'm feeding you too. I can't eat all I want to eat. I can't eat beyond my fullness. I can't just eat because of gluttony. Because others have to eat too. As a Black woman growing up in the South and also attending a predominantly white middle and high school, there was a way in which I didn't have the self-esteem that affirmed me on a daily basis. And it wasn't that I didn't have esteem about myself. It was that who I thought I was constantly being met with criticism or nope, not enough, nope, not it. And so when you're met with that daily battle, even though you wake up like, I don't know if you remember Cat Williams' lion joke, like he's in a tiger and he's in the cage and he's like, I think I'm a tiger, but yet people just looking at me and laughing and snapping, I'm supposed to be the king or whatever. So that's how I felt. And cage in that space. And so there was a lot of juxtaposition of whiteness in my early formative years. But when I went to Spelman and I started to deal with my emotional eating, and by dealing with it, I was able to free emotions, thoughts, feelings that weren't mine, but I've eaten over the years. And so through the freedom of that, there were tools. And that's when it became apparent that, like, if you can free up space in your being, and we free up space by obviously releasing emotions. But I think one of the tools we have right now is our diet. And so what's on your plate is going to instruct your future. I see food this way. And so whatever you eat is going to become you. And we've all heard the saying, you are what you eat, but we just kind of, oh, it's the same. However, when we look at what's there, there you are. And so by starting to use the food as a tool, I was able to see who's showing up. Is it this Shelly who's back there that's feeling insecure place? Or is it this Shelly who's feeling fortified and relevant and valued and loved and honored. And what's on the plate could inform that. So that's what I think about when you talk about these tools in the here and now, is that what's here and now is you all the time. And then you create your future every time you eat. And that future can definitely rest in banana pudding, like we talked about, because banana pudding is delicious. However, do I want it to rest in, let's say, cow's condensed milk that might be treated with antibiotics or hormones? So it's not the cow, it's the antibiotics and hormones. I wanted to focus on that. And then sweetened with white sugar that is so devoid of any value and nutrient of its melanin, literally stripped, whitewashed. And so now it's become a tool for dis-ease in the body. And so maybe I want to consider buying sugar because I need to sweeten it. But maybe there's some sugar with a little bit of the melanin on it. When I'm shopping in Ghana and Jamaica, I don't see white sugar. I see the sugar with melanin on it. So maybe I want to get that. And then because I know that the cow's milk is not responsible, I'm going to use that word, here in my grocery store here in Brooklyn, maybe instead I'm going to look at some coconut milk and see if I can condense that, but create still the need for this, the desire for this banana pudding, and know that what I've taken into me has now, is now responsible for my recreation, my being, my wellness. Yeah, the tools are there and we get to use them every day because we got to eat to live.
Shelly's practice also centers wellness. She passionately espouses the importance of mindfulness in everything, not just in the cultural approach to food we eat, but in the intention we use and our choices all along the food chain.
I hope that we return to, in the lifetime that I'm living and I see it, is a respect for the land. There's a way in which I see these health movements coming up, paleo, vegan, keto, pick one. And what's challenging for me is that when I look at the recipes that are suggested under those, there's a heavy reliance on packaged, processed foods. And that, when I think about Black people specifically, and we talked about this with the amount of trauma that we've experienced, especially in the West, is that our bodies have been failing us. And a lot of what's been happening is because we've been feeding our bodies foods that we think are good for us because we're doing what we know. We're doing what we know. Like you said, eat rice, cool, I'm just going to go get this packaged rice. But not realizing that the package of the rice, whatever is put in it to make sure that it looks presentable by the time it gets to you, is also an ingredient. And so it's not just rice that you're buying. You're also buying whatever is in that. And there was a time where rice was coming from the field. Hello, Gullah Geechee. Hello, South Carolina. So that's no longer our time. And so I pray that we merge the brilliance of technology because it's useful and the brilliance of the land. And we bring those together in ways that are sustainable to both the land and human bodies. That's the first. And then after we do that, I really want us to dig into our souls and our roots and come up with the inspiration that our ancestors had to have had to create what we now get to enjoy. I think a lot of ways we've given over our creativity sometimes to media. And while I celebrate training, while I celebrate technique, I also want us to remember to not get so stuck into that, that we dishonor that natural memory that's seeded in us because we come from a long line of creators and healers. And we can bring that creativity and healing into our food ways and our food practices. And so I see some of us doing it, so I know it's not lost. And I pray that gets amplified in the same way that all these other food movements have had. I know so many women who've come through my practice who have come with the idea that there are good foods and bad foods. And it hurts my heart that there are, because what happens, obviously, when you have that framing is if you eat something that you consider bad, then you yourself become bad. And so you yourself, you start feeling regret and guilt. And then those feelings don't support a thriving well-being and they take away from your vitality, that feeling in itself. And so when we now switch to say, is this for me or is it not? And if it's not for me, it doesn't make it bad because there are 7 billion of us. That means there are 7 billion diets. Let's be real. There's a diet for everyone. You cannot eat the same thing as the other person. And so looking at food as something that is an ally rather than a bad or a good. And now as my ally, I get to tune into you. And I get to ask you, not with my words, but with the action of eating, the action of smelling, the action of feeling, using all of my senses to engage with you and through that communication and that union, I now get to understand better whether or not this is my thing or not. And if it is my thing, the gratitude. Because if you didn't exist, I couldn't. And so now I'm going to ensure that I support. So I don't want to buy you if you're processed, because that's not well-being. You've now been broken down. You've had your vitality taken out of you. So the shell of the thing is there. It's like eating a ghost. The spirit of it is gone. And so now I want to focus on the food that is in its origin state. Because I want to support your well-being as well. I want you to grow. I want you to thrive. So I'm going to support the cooking practices and the farming practices and the marketing practices and the production practices that ensure your survival, not the one that comes to the process. Because no. So yeah, that part, no such thing as good or bad. It's just, it's food. And you get to decide in harmony and in conversation with that food whether or not y'all will have a relationship that you'll do your part in nurturing.
We're going to pause here for a little break, after which we'll be back to chat with my second guest, Dr. Monica O'Connell, about the emotional connections between Kate and our important events. Raising a bar can mean many things. For Talenti, it's about taking the time to make the best gelatos while working to create a more equitable culinary community. For nutritionist Tracy McQuinter, it means crafting recipes that only use plant-based ingredients that are as carefully sourced as they are delicious. In 2020, Tracy started 10,000 Black Vegan Women, a campaign that has helped 15,000 Black women and counting go vegan to live longer, healthier lives. To learn more about Tracy's program and other creators Talenti is supporting within the Black culinary community, follow Talenti on Instagram. Welcome back to Black Desserts, a podcast presented by Black Food Folks. Our next guest is Dr. Monica O'Connell, another multi-talented woman who has created some of the most beautiful cakes I've ever seen.
My name is Monica Hairston O'Connell, and these days, with a certain amount of whimsy, I say I am a journeyer and a baker and a writer and a death doula in training. Multifacetedness is something that I'm really learning how in this 51st year on the planet to just embrace. I have had careers and professional trajectories in a lot of different areas.
I first came across Monica's work through her company, Curtis & Gates. I had admired her via social media for a while and then got the opportunity to cook with her for a Black Southern Traditions dinner at the Beer House back in 2019. It was a beautiful all-women-led dinner. We each got the room to show out and bring the culinary lessons of our mothers and grandmothers into the place. But it was Monica who shut the whole meal down with a stunning display of 12 cakes to celebrate the heirloom of Southern bacon, while also leaving her modern flair on every design. Working with her, I was so inspired by the meticulous artistry she put into her practice. It was this feeling of immediate nostalgia and profound care in every cake that made watching her work joyful masterclass. I've been a fan of hers ever since.
The thing that I love about cake and pastry is I felt like when I started actually baking with awareness and some intention around 2013 or 14, I had this kind of dawning realization that it was a holistic practice for me. There's a way that I think these primarily white institutions just don't make room for our whole selves. And I always struggled with that on some level or another. And I just found like baking was this space where I could bring in the fact that I have a PhD in ethnomusicology and I'm very interested in listening and in sound. The fact that I had been a practicing musician, the fact that I've been a lifelong studier of inner work and spirituality in Jungian thought, for example. The fact that I have always been this kind of nature geek and very interested interested in what seasonal, for example, actually means, what it can be. These kinds of things all found a place in the baking. So I founded Curtis and Cake in 2015 and honestly just learned by making all the mistakes, every last one of them, I think. But I had that business for about 6 years. And during that time, just got to do some really, I feel, extraordinary, beautiful, and personally important work. And the way it is now is just life is what it is, to not be too attached to any particular professional identity or profile. I still bake. I still think about cake all the time, constantly. But the business is formally anyway, no longer. It's more an idea and a sense of self that I carry with me. And I now live on Creek Land, aka Conyers, Georgia, and hella regular now. I'm working in HR, but I'm trying to keep these ideas and thoughts alive and trying to regenerate some libido, some life energy around writing again, because there are a lot of connections that I want to make.
For Monica, the primary function of her work is as an artistic outlet. I love that because there's something profound about investing time, creativity, and intention into a form that has such a short lifespan. In this next part of our conversation, we talk about the perceived frivolity of cake, the power of ephemera, and consumable art.
I think anything that is seemingly or understood as ephemeral has the risk of coming off as frivolous or as not important. There's something about, you know, we want permanence, and you can see that all over this culture. And I think it's misguided because there is no such thing. There isn't. And it just goes back to this idea of impermanence, and it's the fact that it's ephemeral, it's impermanent, it's not. And when I used to do my wedding work, and I'm biased because I'm the cake person, but I would always think the cake, if you would just think about it, folks, is really the important symbol of this ritual here, because it speaks to your values and what matters about nourishment and about impermanence and about beauty in all of these really deep ways. But yeah, I think to me, a thoughtful cake has taken all of that into consideration. I know in my wedding work, there's so much time spent with my client where I'm just trying to learn about them and learn about their values and their aesthetic sense and all their, whatever you call those things, but they have the whole vision board or whatever, you know, and trying to bring all of that in a thoughtful, not prescriptive Pinterest kind of way, but in a way that's really unique to them. Bring that all together in the cake, in its design, in the flavor combinations, etc. I want it to reflect those two. It's an important life moment. And the repast is so important. It's the space has so much beauty and weight and meaning and really untapped potential still, I think, in a lot of ways, to have that same kind of care and attention going into the cake specifically. It comes out in other ways. There's storytelling. There's a soundscape that's specific to those kinds of events. I have been listening to a whole bunch of different podcasts, but I listened to this podcast the other day where the person getting interviewed was a pretty high profile mycologist. And she was just talking about ecologies and best practices in foraging for mushrooms. And she was talking about how, so say you're looking for chanterelles. You don't just go out into the forest and hope you get lucky or whatever. Chanterelles are a part of a system. You have to look for chanterelles among the other things that make chanterelles thrive. They're all connected. You have to go to the chanterelle habitat. If you're looking for another kind of mushroom, you have to go to that mushroom's habitat. Those things come together in this way. They constellate together. They help each other thrive. And I guess I just feel like, I don't know if it's a stretch, but I feel that way about cake. It's like, where there is cake, for us, what are the connections? What else has to be there? If the cake is there, it means something. It means that other things that are important to us are also there. It means that family's there, likely. It means that connection's there. It means that some kind of recognition of life and life cycles are there. Ceremony is there. If the cake had been thoughtfully made, some level of sustainability is there. some sense of kith and kinship are there. So that's why for me, it can't be overstated. It's almost like this archetypal symbol. It's the hub of the wheel. So using cake as a way to think about how all of these aspects of our lives nestle in and are living together in this intimate way that makes meaning for us. So I can look at the nostalgia and I can think about the nostalgic idea of like a pure Leah Chase butter cake. There's something about that that takes you to a certain place that creates certain ideals in your head. But when you're trying to recreate that, I guess it's not so much about, I hate those kind of like, how can I elevate this thing? There is no elevation. The thing was already perfect. The thing is trying to teach you something. So it's like, what can I learn from Leah Chase through this perfect butter cake, and how can I keep that relevance and pay it forward in a way? So a lot of those things that I read about nostalgia, like people who are theorizing on nostalgia, I think they maybe forget that part. Yeah, that it is, it's kinetic. It needs to be constantly moving. It's a space to refer to, but I think if you let that space stagnate, then you are moving into what those theorists call melancholy. It's something where you're not seeing that door that has to be opened into the future. You don't want to see that door. You want to stay in that space. You want to wrap yourself in that blanket and stay in there. But I think the usefulness, at least for me, of this, the nostalgia, and there's so many rich versions in Black baking traditions, is to keep it moving, to use it as a tool for to educate myself, to evolve. How can this space of nostalgia or this recipe or this cake or whatever it is help me care better and attend more thoughtfully to others?
Over the past 18 months, because of the global pandemic, as well as the violence against our communities, we've all had to confront our own mortality. Monica has experienced many life changes during this time, ranging from professional transition to profound family loss. Through it all, she's turned back into her art and has decided to channel her emotions into her baking by developing a new framework for her practice.
It is a process that I'm interested in exploring because, yeah, these last, almost 2 years have been ridiculous for me and for our community just generally. For me personally, I lost a professional path that I thought was going to be really joyous one. I lost a mother. I lost a father in just such a short space. And we lost so many people collectively. We lost Floyd. We lost Arbery. We lost Taylor. We lost so many others that weren't even named. And this grief, too, that we're all experiencing collectively around just what things we're still learning we have lost and need to rethink with this pandemic. You know, that's very much still in play. And the cakes just had my back in this way through that. They were this way for me to think through my own grief and ground my own grief, be with my own grief. Sometimes you have to make that. And that's what projections are in a way. Your thing onto something else so that you can see it, so that you can work with it. And I felt like the cakes were doing some of this work for me. I was able to project some of this grief onto them. I called them grief cakes. Just work around when my mom passed, designed a cake. It was a cake model. I didn't even bake it. I just wanted to design something that was beautiful, that even started in the tiniest way to speak to just the depth of beauty that she has. And so that designing process was really interesting for me. I designed one for Ahmad. I designed one for Brianna. And that process was just a way for me to work through that, but also a way to honor these folks who were not going to have any more birthdays with their families in that way. Like, how have these people's birthdays and those moments of joy gotten just snatched from them like that? How has that happened? Just snatched. So I guess I was trying to work with this idea of the fact that the joy and the celebration of life is just always right up next to that knowledge that ain't none of us gonna be here forever for whatever reason. And for those of us who are living in the wake, as Christina Sharp would put it, right, of Black existence. That ceasing to exist can happen in any number of ways at any time. We're living with that knowledge constantly. So I feel like there's something about the work with the cake that can speak to the fact that we always are learning how to better reckon with the, whether we want it or not, just the closeness, the intimacy of our joy and that grief that we all hold together. And I'll just say that the doula work specifically is showing me that. The fact is that they're both there. It's the Janus face. It's two sides of the coin. But the doula work is showing me that the deeper we go into the knowledge that we are all going to die, the brighter or the more intense the joy as well. And I think that's something important for us to all hold. Just being able to sit with it and acknowledge it and work through it. And to a certain extent, heal what grief there is, heal what trauma there is across generations. That makes our joy deeper. It was such a surprising aspect of growing into the cake work to realize how much just pleasure I get out of creating things that were beautiful with my hands. It just makes me just so happy and I don't know, and proud. That's where I enter into such a beautiful flow state. But I think some of that impetus really just started from thinking about our traditions, our tables, Black women, caring about the beauty of the table, the way we carry ourselves, wanting to look sharp, the swagger. And there's a kind of, there's even a phrase for it, like it's like shabby hospitality or something like that. Like the idea that you want to welcome people in, they just drop over, your house is clean or whatever. That's great. That's great. I'm working towards that. I'm a Virgo, so I need my stuff to be clean. But the other part of that continuum that I see in Black women's traditions is, here is one of the ways that we show care and respect, is that table is just going to be so beautiful. My mother was just a master at this. Beautiful tablescapes. The food was arranged in these ways that were just so pleasing to the eye. This before you even taste anything. So I'm always just thinking about that and thinking about the way that we present ourselves to in the world. So just that style piece alone. And then also just thinking about just my walks outside and the way that I like can geek out looking at different plants and trying to learn about them and flowers and things like that. So when I started I've taken a couple now courses with Maggie Austin, who I think is just the one as far as the sugar flower work goes. And Maggie, in the first class I took, we were learning how to make a sugar rose. And we got to the section where we're learning how to dust the sugar flower with the powders that kind of give it a little depth of color and make it a little more dimensional and lifelike. And I just remember so clearly her saying, look, you don't, what was the word she used? You don't want them to be too friendly. You want to put a little death on it. That stuck with me. Even then, before I was going on this kind of journey with the doula work, et cetera, yes, that's what makes the flower beautiful. It's not going to be here forever. That's what makes it precious. In a certain way in your mind, in that timeline, it has already gone. As far as connecting the skill sets to this sort of philosophy is just about giving myself the freedom to stay open to impressions and see what comes up. So with Maud's cake, which I was so happy with how it turned out, I run too. You know, Fred Moten talks about going through the woods or going on these walks and the ghosts of runaways or hearing the hounds. So I can't remember the beautiful poetic way he most likely put it.
That fugitivity, right? The freedom, the sort of safe space, finding it some kind of in this complicated world that Blackness, our Blackness, is a fugitive space. That is this one, oh, yes, ma'am.
And aren't we too supposed to be able to go outside and get that solace? Doesn't every single wellness guide include that in the top 5 ways you can regulate your nervous system? So it's like, can we or what? That connection and thinking about the trails that I was running on at the time and thinking, in spite of the ghosts that are there with me and in spite of the fact that I have to in some kind of state of vigilance and listen for the ways that the twigs are, you know, cracking or whatever, there's still a way that my soul can be in right relationship when I'm out in those woods and I'm hearing those birds and looking at these fallen trees in different states of decay. And so there was something about that tension that I wanted to capture in his cake. And it was the first time I had worked with wafer paper to try to create these sort of lichen and the shelf fungi and just trying to create this thing that will have the markers of what's beautiful about being in the forest on these runs. The little stones that kind of glisten like jewels in the bottom of the creek, all that stuff. But at the same time, the fact that death is constantly happening and no place like the forest will teach you that. It's beautiful there and natural there and not so much in other places. But wanting to honor him, you know, like reclaim some of the beauty of this man's life and create the biggest cake in celebration of his life and just speak to the ways that we are just connected, even though I had never met him, was a great healing experience for me. It was like a prayer for me.
And that brings us to the end of episode 5 of Black Desserts. I want to thank both my guests, Shelly Chapman and Dr. Monica O'Connell, for sharing their thoughts on the light and shade of Afro-nostalgia. I hope that listening to their stories has inspired you to become more intentional, not only in the food that you eat, but in all the areas of your daily life. You can follow Shelly on Instagram at Shelly Wellness. And don't forget to subscribe to her YouTube channel, The Mindful Plate. You can follow Dr. O'Connell on Instagram at Mimi_O'Connell. And even though her bakery is closed, you can still marvel at her beautiful cakes on Instagram as well at Curtis and Cake. Thank you for listening to another episode of Black Desserts. I'm your host, Therese Nelson. And if you're enjoying the series, I'd love if you could subscribe, rate, and comment on the episodes wherever you're listening. We love to hear from you and we value your feedback. Black Desserts is a limited series podcast presented by Clay Williams and Colleen Vincent, founders of Black Food Folks. The show is made possible by continued support of our sponsor, Talenti Gelato and Sorbetto. Black Desserts is produced by the brilliant creative team of Whetstone Media, led by founder Steven Satterfield, season 2 producer Marvin Yu, editor Mary Creedon, intern Kyla Stone, and supervising producer, Celine Glazer.